freely given. It had to be dug out bit by bit, like chips of Ellerite from mountain rock. "Let's go in and see who he's meeting," said Aaron decisively. "Stay out of sight." He was about to set off when Grubb hissed at him. "Wait," he said. "Look." Two men were approaching the burned bear from the other direction. They were straight-backed and tall, with the stern, blonde, good looks of well-bred Crodans. Their clothes were unremarkable, but their arrogant stride gave them away. These were no passing citizens. The swords at their hips were fine and well cared for, and they entered the inn with solemn purpose.
"Grubb reckon we're not the only ones interested in Kiel."
Aaron felt himself go cold. If these were the men Kiel had come to meet, they clearly meant him no kindness. He hurried up the alley towards the inn.
"Well, much luck going. Croden's got swords," Grubb said, scampering behind him.
"Yes," said Aaron, "and Kiel doesn't know it. Want to do something heroic, or are you going to stay out here?"
Grubb swore in the language of his homeland and followed.
The inn was cramped and busy, hot with bodies and heaving. Laughter, smoke, and threat hung in the air. Sailors and locals of half a dozen races ate and drank at the tables, and whores slid between them. A ship must have come in recently. The docks were not far from here. Aaron pushed his way in, his stomach tight with nerves. Ordinarily he'd steer clear of an establishment like this. The clientele were hard-eyed and gruff, nothing like the friendly faces at the Cross Keys in Shoal Point. He was a boy again here, not the man he'd started to become. He spotted the Crodans heading through the common room to a doorway on the far side. Grubb hissed in his ear, having spotted two more Crodans sitting at a corner table, out of place among the roguish patrons. They exchanged a glance with their fellows as they passed.
"Grubb think Bitterbracker in real trouble," he murmured.
They could do nothing but follow the men through the doorway into a larger room with a bar at its centre, where they found Kiel in conversation with a big-bellied man in an apron, who Aaron took to be the innkeeper. Kiel passed him a coin and received a folded letter in exchange, which he tucked inside his jerkin. He didn't notice the Crodans approaching him from behind, eyes fixed on him. There was no doubt left in Aaron's mind now. They meant to arrest him or kill him.
"Come on," said Grubb. "Outside. We follow. See where they take him."
Aaron felt suddenly, overwhelmingly grateful to the Skull for that suggestion. Yes, that was what they should do. Intervening would bring the Crodans down on their heads. Doing nothing would be cowardice. This was the middle ground that would allow him to live with his conscience while staying out of danger. And if Kiel was slain first, or if they couldn't save him from whatever torture the Crodans had in mind, well, at least he'd have tried. What more could he do, really? Where was the sense in pitting himself against overwhelming odds? What was the point in getting them all killed to save one? Some window of understanding gaped in his mind, and he heard those words on the lips of 1,000 Ossian nobles as they laid down their arms before the Crodans. Heard it on Randall's lips too. For the first time ever, he saw into his father's heart and thought he knew him.
But he wasn't his father.
"Kiel!" he screamed at the top of his lungs. "It's a trap!"
The Crodans at the bar whirled. Kiel did too, and he registered the danger in an instant. His meat knife appeared in his hand, and as the Crodans belatedly drew their swords, he threw himself into them, driving his blade into the eye of the nearest as they all went crashing to the floor. The crowd erupted into chaos. Men scrambled back from the combatants, shoving their fellows before them, who tumbled over stools and barged into others. Drinks were knocked to the floor and punches thrown in blind reaction. In seconds, the fragile peace inside the burned bear collapsed. Aaron was pitched this way and that in a churning sea of limbs, fighting to keep his balance. The corner of a table hammered into his thigh. Grubb had disappeared in the melee. He caught sight of Kiel through the crowd, struggling on the floor with his surviving assailant, his face spattered with blood. The Crodans had swords, but at such close quarters a short blade was better. He saw Kiel raise the reddened knife again, his face a savage rictus of hate. The Croden screamed in fear, and then the crowd closed in, and Aaron mercifully saw no more. Rough arms seized him. A square-jawed face loomed in his vision, eyes dull with authority. One of the Crodens who'd been waiting inside. He struggled, but he was pinned against a table which gave way beneath him, sending him and his captor to the ground in a rain of mugs and platters. Frantically, he fought to get out from underneath the Croden. Booted feet stamped and thundered all around him, inches from his nose. Suddenly the Croden rocked sideways as he was kicked hard in the head. He rolled off Aaron, dazed, and Grubb lunged down, stabbing. The Croden jerked twice and lay still. Grubb pulled Aaron up as the bar went from brawling disorder to panic. The hot scent of murder was in the air.
"More Crodens coming! Go!"
Grubb shoved him into the crowd and was quickly lost to sight. Aaron stumbled towards the back of the room, where most of the patrons were disappearing through a rear door. He couldn't find Keel anywhere. Handbells began ringing outside, the same alarm call he'd heard before the road patrol caught them at the Reaver's Rest. Men with swords pushed in, and the rear door was blocked. The main door would surely be covered by now, too. He saw a booth next to a window. With no better idea, he shoved towards it, slipped into the booth, and wrenched at the latch. It didn't move, painted shut. Desperately, he snatched up a stool. His first blow bounced off the lead lattice and didn't even crack the glass. It took two more blows before the cheap glue gave way and the window fell out of its frame in a rain of diamond-shaped panes. Someone shouted "Halt!" in Croden, and he knew it was meant for him, but he wasn't to be halted now. He wriggled out through the window and tumbled into the dirty gutter beyond. Panting, he got to his feet. A short distance to his left, standing at the corner where he could see the entrance to the inn, was a man he recognized. He wore a black coat, showing the double-barred cross of the Iron Hand, and there was a long, thin sword at his belt. Hart. Their eyes met, and for the briefest of instants, a flash fire swept across Aaron's mind. He wanted to throw himself at Hart, knock him down, strangle him with his bare hands. But it was an instant only, and then cold sense took hold, and he ran.
"Get back here, boy!" Hart cried, and launched into pursuit.
Sailors were still milling about the rear entrance of the Burned Bear, trying to see what was going on inside. Aaron dodged past them at a sprint. A Croden reached out to stop him, an iron guardsman in disguise like all the rest, but Aaron jinked away, and his fingers only brushed Aaron's arm. The street ended where it was crossed by a sloped and busy road. Aaron ran out into it, darting in front of a cart. The horse reared with a snort, scraping at the air with its hooves, and the driver's curses followed him downhill. He glanced over his shoulder and saw Hart catching up with him through the traffic. The Croden who'd tried to grab him had also joined the chase, arms pumping as he ran in the watchman's wake. Tall, athletic men, perfect specimens of Croden manhood. Aaron was quick and nimble, but not as fit, and his stride was shorter. They'd run him down, given time. Aaron redoubled his speed, boots pounding, blood thumping in his ears as he searched for an escape. The crowded street descended sharply before him. To his left were rows of houses and shops, no shelter there. To his right, a low wall guarded against the drop to the next street, which ran parallel to this one, but much lower, almost at the level of the river. He could see onto the roofs of the buildings there, which rose almost to the height of the wall, but there was no obvious way down.
"Stop that boy!" Hart cried.
People slowed to look for him, but Aaron had already raced past. Then he saw the soldiers ahead and realized who Hart had been shouting to. Two stern men in the black and white livery of the Croden army appeared in his path, standing low and ready to catch him. With only a moment to act, he dug in his heels, ran to the side of the road and vaulted the wall. Terror seized him as he swung his legs over the edge. If he'd miscalculated, there had been nothing but a hard drop to the street several stories below. But when he cleared the wall, the rooftop was there, only a half dozen feet below him, as he'd hoped it would be. He landed with a jolt and kept running. The roof was bare but for a pile of decaying crates and a rickety old jib. He fled towards a door on the far side. Risking a look over his shoulder, he saw Hart jumping down after him, closer on his heels than he'd imagined. The other iron guardsmen followed, but the soldiers, clad in armour, were too heavy to risk the jump. The door was little more than a few planks nailed together, held shut by a rusty padlock. Driven by fear of the men at his back, Aaron shoulder-charged the door at a run. It smashed open before him, rotten wood splintering, and he found himself at the top of a bare stone stairway. Shoulder smarting from the blow, he pelted down the steps and into a spacious room, musty with long emptiness. Old blankets and rat-eaten sacks had accumulated in the corners. Once it had been a small warehouse, but it was abandoned now and had fallen into dilapidation. Aaron ran for the first door he could see. Hart was far too close behind to do otherwise. Birds exploded in a flutter from the sill of a window as he passed. A floorboard split beneath his feet, sending him stumbling. He fell, landed hard on his hands, scrambled up again. The door was there in front of him, its lock broken and hanging ajar. He shoved it open. Unexpected daylight brought him to a halt, and he found himself at the top of an exterior staircase. Once it had run down the front of the building, but it had long since rotted in the dank air of the canal district, and all that was left was a precarious landing projecting out over an alley. He cursed and turned to seek another route, but Hart had already run into the room and was between Aaron and the exit. He slowed as he saw Aaron's predicament. An ironic smile slid across his face as he drew his sword. His companion appeared and began to circle round to prevent Aaron from getting past them. Cornered, Aaron took a step backwards onto the landing. It creaked alarmingly beneath him as he peered over his shoulder. There was no chance of climbing down the wall, but the alley was narrow and the building opposite leaned close. There was a small balcony jutting out from it, one story below him, surrounded by an iron railing with a shuttered door leading inside. Could he make that jump? No, that was desperation talking. He'd fall short and break his legs for sure. Nails pinged and wood groaned as the landing threatened to come away from the wall. Aaron lurched back into the room.
"No way out?" said Hart. "That's a shame. That's a real shame."
Aaron pulled his knife from his belt. One of Raffa's men had given it to him in the bathhouse of a Croden work camp. Now he held it out before him, a feeble ward against the swords of his enemies. It felt like the only thing to do.
"You want to resist arrest?" said Hart. "Please do. I'm sure you remember how well that worked out for your father."
Aaron's knuckles whitened on the hilt of his knife. He saw again his father struggling amid a mass of iron guardsmen, Hart holding a dagger to his throat, the look in his father's eyes as the blade was driven home. Rage surged through him, sweeping aside all possibility of surrender. To submit to his father's killer was something he could never do. He flipped the knife in his hand and flung it spinning through the air towards Hart's forehead. It flew harmlessly past his shoulder and clattered to the floor on the far side of the room. Hart let out a surprised laugh.
"My, you're quite the formidable assassin, aren't you?"
Aaron felt a stab of impotent fury. There was no way he could beat this man today, no matter how much he wanted to. Instead, he turned and ran out onto the landing. He clambered up on the wooden railing, braced himself, and before he could think better of it, he jumped. Arms wheeling, he dropped through the air, throat locked shut with the terror of the plunge. He crashed down hard on the balcony, knees buckling, and slammed into the shuttered door with such force it turned his vision white. Dizzily, he struggled to his feet and rattled the door. It was securely locked, but that didn't matter. The balcony was only two stories high. He could hang off it and drop down into the alley. Hart appeared in the doorway of the warehouse landing and let out a cry of rage as he saw Aaron on the balcony. Aaron gave him a defiant grin. Ignoring the pain of his bruised muscles, he clambered over the rail and dropped to the cobbles below.
"You're claimed, you little bastard!" Hart roared,
his oily sarcasm replaced by bald fury. He stepped out onto the landing, climbed up on the railing, and readied himself to spring. But the rotten wood had been tested enough. It broke beneath his weight, and Hart, unbalanced, lunged forwards as the landing fell apart beneath him. Aaron dodged away from the falling wood as Hart plummeted through the air with a yell, but the watchman had put enough strength into his jump to clear the alleyway and landed on the balcony in a helpless tumble. Aaron stood where he was, staring. He knew he should run, but he had to see if his father's killer was dead. It was too much to hope for. Hart stirred with a stifled groan of pain. His companion appeared in the warehouse doorway, but now the landing was gone, he had no way down except back through the building.
"I'll kill you, boy," Hart snarled, levering himself up with the help of the balcony railing. "I swear to the Primus, I'll kill you."
Aaron fled. Behind him, Hart climbed over the railing and dropped down into the alley. His leg gave way as he landed, and he screamed and collapsed. But by the time Aaron reached the corner of the alley, he was getting up again, unstoppable in his wrath.
"I'll kill you!"
he screamed again, and came limping after Aaron, wincing and wheezing whenever he put his weight on his damaged leg. Aaron sprinted out of the alleyway into a small cobbled plaza, where a canal dead-ended to form a miniature harbour. A dozen boats were moored haphazardly around a stone quay, and the waterside was cluttered with nets waiting to be repaired and piles of lobster pots. Stalls sold whelks and cress to the men and women who idled nearby, waiting for the next cargo to arrive. Their conversations faltered as Aaron burst through, running for his life.
"Stop!"
cried Hart as he limped to the mouth of the alleyway. Small chance of that, Aaron thought. Hart had been injured in the fall, and his companion was far behind. There was no way they could catch him. A fierce smile spread across his face as he crossed the plaza. He'd outrun them. He'd escaped. Something caught against his foot, and he fell and smacked hard against the ground. The shock of the impact stunned him, and he tasted blood. Dazed, he tried to raise himself. He'd tripped. Somehow he'd tripped. Rough hands pulled him up, twisting his arms behind his back. He saw the grizzled faces of the men of the canal district, set hard as they held him. He hadn't tripped. He'd been tripped. Disbelief rendered him speechless for an instant. When he found his voice, it was strangled and mewling.
"You're Ossians!" he cried, appalled.
He struggled, but they had him fast. Hart was limping across the plaza towards him, a knife in his hand and murder in his eyes.
"Why are you helping him?"
His answer was a punch in the gut, driving the wind from him. He sagged in their arms, wheezing and helpless. When Hart reached him, he seized Aaron by the throat and propelled him backwards, out of the hands of his captors and up against a wall. The Ossians fell away, cowed by the sign of the iron hand and the blade Hart pressed to Aaron's throat. The watchman's face was inches from Aaron's, eyes bulging and teeth gritted. Aaron could feel the heat of his anger as the knife edge bit into his skin. That crazed stare promised death, and he was taken by a terror he'd never known before. He couldn't die like this, killed by the blade that killed his father, betrayed by his own people. He squeezed his eyes shut. "Meshuk, Johar, anyone, please!" A drop of blood trickled down onto his collarbone. He heard Hart's heaving breath, smelled his hate, and tensed for the final cut.
"No," said Hart.
The knife withdrew. Aaron opened his eyes, trembling, confused.
"No, that's exactly what he'd want me to do. It's just the excuse he needs."
His voice was thoughtful, sly. "One last black mark on my record." Hart took a shuddering breath, smoothed his damp hair back across his scalp, and made a visible effort to control himself. Then he grabbed Aaron, turned him around and slammed him up against the wall again, cheek first. Aaron was too weak with shock to resist as manacles closed around his wrists.
"Don't think it's your lucky day, you vile little rat," Hart hissed. "You'll wish you were dead by the time we're done with you. By the Primus, I'm going to see you suffer. But first..."
He grabbed a fistful of hair, yanked his head back painfully, and leaned in close to his ear.
First, you'll talk.
70. Ropes creaked, pulleys squeaked, and sailcloth flapped in the wind. Gulls wheeled high over the granite-flagged docks of Morganholm. Swifts darted between the ratlines of towering ships, while sailors smoked and cursed happily on the quay, and stevedores unloaded cargoes from across the known world to be sold in the shops and dens of the capital. Garrick stood in the window of a Zulan merchant vessel, its gunwales carved with cavorting nudes and the Pradap Tet as its figurehead. Nearby, handlers were loading a cart with four large barrels and a dozen smaller iron-bound ones, moving them slowly and with extreme care. Garrick wondered if he should be standing further back in case of an accident, but on reflection he supposed it didn't matter. Without that cargo, all was lost anyway. Katat Az had delivered on time, but that was no surprise. Zulans were a trustworthy folk by reputation, because reputation was what they lived and died by. In a culture that had elevated gossip and rumour-mongering to a martial art, what was said about somebody was more important than any truth. Zulan merchants cultivated a reputation for honesty and reliability by being honest and reliable, and they charged accordingly. Anyone who didn't like it could take their chances with a Carthanian. The merchandise was here, at least. One more piece in place. But there was so much more that needed to go right before the end, and so many things that could go wrong. He pushed the thought aside. Doubt was a luxury he couldn't allow himself. His course was set, whatever the consequence.
"Lane of Heath Edge, by my breath," said a voice at his shoulder.
Wilhelm the Smiler was a small, slight man, freckled, baby-faced, his hair orange as a carrot. He had the innocent grin of someone comical, pitiable and harmless. Never had Garrick known anyone whose appearance so belied the person behind it.
"It's Garrick now, as you well know," said Garrick. "Lane died at Salt Fork."
"As did many who shared our cause," said Wilhelm. "And all for the cowardice of weak men too afraid of their rulers to resist them."
He bowed his head.
"It was a brave try. There are not many left who dare such bold moves."
"Not many willing to bear the cost," Garrick replied.
"The wheels of change are greased with blood," said Wilhelm. "You know it as I do. Always surprises me how many think they can win their freedom without doing anything unpleasant."
Garrick grunted, and they stood in silence a moment, watching the Zulans load the barrels into the hired cart. If the Iron Hand came sniffing, they'd left no trail to Mara's house.
"They say General Dakin himself will be at the wedding," said Wilhelm.
He smiled when he said it. He smiled a lot, even when there was nothing to smile about. It didn't always mean he was amused.
"I don't doubt it," said Garrick.
"The very man who stole the Ember Blade from our lands 30 years ago, when he was nothing but an upstart captain. He's going to present it to the prince. Quite an honour."
His eyes were shrewd behind the shield of his grin.
"Think you could take a detour and kill that bastard while you're about your business in Hammerholt?"
He was only half joking.
"Who says that's not my reason for going there?"
Wilhelm grinned wider.
"Because I know you, Garrick. Murdering Dakin would serve no purpose but your own satisfaction. You always thought bigger than that."
"Reckon I should kill the prince, then?"
"Ha! If only you could get close enough."
"I'll poison him."
"All you'd do is kill his wine tasters. No, it's the Ember Blade you're after, and don't say otherwise. If you should get it, though, and you need a place to hide it..."
He spread his arms.
"None know the city like I do."
"I'll keep it in mind," said Garrick. "How goes the struggle in Morganholm?"
"Well enough. We intercepted a shipment of weapons meant for the garrison, and now we have more sword and armour than we know what to do with. There was a Croden judge getting too free with the noose, started hanging Ossians for his own amusement by the end, so we hanged him for ours.
And then there are the informers, always them.
Informers, Garrick echoed, disgusted. There was no lower creature than an Ossian who sold out their kinfolk for coin or advantage.
Seems our current range of discouragement still aren't getting through to some, said Willem. Reckon we need to up the ante. Target partners and families, too.
Children, Garrick said. That sat ill with him.
It's a fine line you tread, Wilhelm.
People have to learn. Lie with the Crodans and there are consequences. A man will risk his own neck if he thinks he can get away with it. He'll think twice before risking those he loves.
Garrick said nothing.
This was Wilhelm's city, Wilhelm's choice, and sacrifices had to be made. But he thought the smiling man should take care if he went that route.
Resistance was a dirty business, but it was all for nothing if they became worse than those they resisted.
"When do we move?" he said.
"Tomorrow night. I have a man on the inside at the vintner's yard who can let us in through the side gate."
"Good."
Wilhelm was vicious, but he was clever and thorough. Garrick had faith that the plan was sound.
"We'll collect the cart from Mara's in the morning, with the fake amberline barrels.
They're being delivered today."
"Perfect. Once we have everything ready, you'll meet us shortly after 7th bell of dark. We'll get you into the false compartment in the cart, then exchange it for a real one. In and out, quick as that. But you should be prepared. It won't be comfortable, and you'll be in there a long time. A night and day, at least."
He'd planned for that. Water to drink, towels to stuff into his underclothes for when he wet himself, herbs to cause constipation. Maybe Vika could give him something for cramp if she woke in time. The corruption round her wound was almost gone.
It would be an undignified, painful ordeal, but when the odds were not in your favour, you had to be ready to do what other men wouldn't.
History would forget the sordid details as long as he triumphed in the end.
"I'm ready," Garrick said, "and you'll be too busy enjoying your stolen amberline to worry about me."
"Ha! You think I'd drink them? Their sale will go towards the cause, my friend. I already have a buyer champing at the bit."
"You're a man of principle and sobriety, Wilhelm. I always admired that about you."
His eyes widened in alarm.
"Careful, you fool!"
One of the Zulan handlers, distracted by something on the docks, bumped against his companion, who was coming up behind him with the last of the small barrels. The man carrying the barrel teetered for a moment, wide-eyed with alarm until the other man grabbed it and steadied him. He looked equally afraid and relieved as he stepped out of the way. His companion gently loaded the barrel into place on the cart and gave the other a lethal glare as they hinged up the tailgate. Wilhelm cast a sly glance at Garrick.
"Mind telling me what's in those barrels?"
"I'll see you tomorrow night, Wilhelm," Garrick said.
Wilhelm smiled.
"I can't wait."
71. The Iron Hands headquarters was a terrifyingly innocuous building, tall and plain, hoarding its secrets within. It bore no indication of its purpose, yet still people quickened their step as they passed. Violence at the hands of Erds or foreign armies was one kind of fear, but this was something else. It was death made bland, murder in plain sight. Aaron sat on a bare wooden chair, his wrists manacled and chained to a ring in the floor, lit by the wan, shivering light of a lantern. His head hung, and his chest was so tight it hurt to breathe. They'd marched him past the torture chamber on the way to his cell, and he'd glimpsed what was inside. Cages, hammers, a rack. Blades laid out as if for surgery. He knew they'd done it on purpose, to show him what awaited, but he couldn't put it from his mind. If they were trying to scare him, it had worked. "You'll talk," Hart had told him. And he would, in the end. Everyone did. It was only a matter of time. Footsteps approached down the corridor, moving with the swift clip of authority. He heard low voices outside. The awful anticipation almost made him retch, and he fought to control his breathing. Who else had they got? Keel? Grubb? Who else was talking right now? The key turned in the lock.
The door was opened by the stern captain who'd previously escorted him to his cell. His name was Dressel. He moved aside, and Overwatchman Clisson stepped in. Aaron's eyes widened in recognition. It was the first time he'd seen him close up since the day his father was killed. He was small and unassuming, with weak, watery features, but none of that mattered when he wore the black coat and double-barred cross of the Iron Hand. Aaron hated him and feared him in equal measure. Dressel closed the door, leaving Clisson alone with Aaron. The Overwatchman stood before him, assessing him, his eyes lizard calm behind his spectacles. He didn't speak. The silence dragged out until Aaron was hardly able to bear it. He was desperate to know what Clisson intended to do with him, and was about to ask, but he spotted the trap and held his tongue. "He wants me to babble and plead, to give myself away. He wants me to tell him things I shouldn't." "What did he say to you?" Clisson asked at last. "What did Garrick say to make you follow him? You must have realized you were of no interest to the Iron Hand after you escaped Sulla's bluff. You could have gone anywhere, started again. Instead, because of him, here you are." He began to walk around the cell, circling behind Aaron. It made Aaron nervous to have him where he couldn't see him, like losing track of a spider in a room. He half expected a blow from behind. "Garrick was your father's sworn enemy," Clisson went on. "He would have hunted him down and killed him like a dog if he could. What could he possibly have said to make you betray your own blood?" Aaron couldn't help tensing at that. He hadn't considered that joining Garrick's cause might be a betrayal of his father's memory. Gods, he'd not only joined him, but on occasion he'd found himself looking up to him, the way he'd once looked up to Randall. Somehow, he'd avoided thinking about it, with the same willful ignorance he'd practiced back when he admired the Crodans. But Clisson had put it in his head now, and it gnawed at him. "I knew something of your father," said Clisson, tapping the lantern to steady the flame. "You knew nothing of him," Aaron thought venomously, but already he wondered if that were true, if Clisson knew more than he himself did. "Men like him are the reason Ossia thrives today," Clisson went on. "You've seen this city, its shopping districts and boulevards. You've seen the people celebrating, eager for the wedding to come. Do they look unhappy to you? Because if you think that is slavery, if you think that is oppression, then you have not seen Brunland. Your father saw the futility of resisting and wanted to save his countryfolk. The Brunlanders fought to the bitter end, and the end, when it came, was bitter indeed." He returned to stand before Aaron, who watched him warily. He wanted to know what Clisson knew, but wouldn't give him the satisfaction of asking. "It takes a strong man to accept loss with grace," Clisson said, "and a clever man to make best advantage of it. Your father and others like him were strong and clever. They lost the war, but won the peace." Then his expression darkened. "The man you call Garrick did not agree with their philosophy. He has, to date, personally murdered 6 Ossian highborns whom he believed complicit in Ossia's surrender. He has been involved in the deaths of 5 more." That was a cold shock to Aaron, but he kept it off his face. "It's a lie," he thought. But was it? How much did he know of that man, really? "And of course he was very eager to kill your father," Clisson added. "Garrick didn't kill my father," said Aaron. "You did." He saw a flicker of triumph in Clisson's eyes and cursed himself silently. He hadn't intended to engage with his interrogator, but Clisson's questions had got under his skin. "We did not want him dead. Watchman Hart was forced to execute him only after your father slew several members of the Iron Guard." Clisson spread his hands helplessly. "We had only intended to arrest him." Again, sowing doubt. Everything he said had the ring of truth to it, and Garrick had kept him in the dark so much that Aaron didn't have any solid grounds to disbelieve him. But Clisson was a Crodan,
and Croden's lied.
"Whatever dream Garrick sold you, it is just that, a dream," Clisson said. "Ossia is part of the Croden Empire, and most Ossians are happy about it. We brought you order and prosperity. We protect you from the Eluru across the sea and Harrow to the north." Aaron snorted. That small defiance gave him courage.
"You don't believe me," Clisson said. "Well, we were all young once, idealistic and naive. We all thought we could change the world. But civilization is a structure too massive and rigid to be altered. You may knock down a pillar here and there, but new ones will replace them. You may repaint the facade, but what lies beneath remains the same. Attacking it is futile. You may as well attack a mountain."
He took off his spectacles and polished them with the sleeve of his coat. "It's time to grow up. Time you learned to deal with the way things are, not the way you wish them to be."
He put his spectacles back on and gazed gravely at Aaron.
"Tell me where he is."
Aaron looked away. He couldn't meet Clisson's eyes. He saw the torture chamber in his mind again, the instruments of agony, and tried not to think about how they'd be put to use. There had to be some way out of this, some way he could avoid what was to come. His mind raced, searching for an escape.
"I have interrogated many prisoners in my time," said Clisson. "They all feel the need to put up a fight, if only so they can live with themselves afterwards. But I always find out what I want to know."
He leaned closer.
"I think you're smarter than that. Tell me willingly, and you will be set free once we have him. Or you can try to keep silent and be tortured, and afterwards you will be hanged. Either way, I will have my answer."
Aaron closed his eyes, forcing calm upon himself. Clisson was right. Aaron would talk in the end. Garrick had already cost his father his life. Should Aaron give up his life too, out of loyalty to a man he hardly knew?
"There's something I'm missing," he thought.
He fought to see past the uniform, the cell, the terror of it all, to see Clisson as he was. "To overcome your enemy, you must first understand him."
"What about Cade?" he asked.
"I won't give you Cade."
"I'll see he escapes punishment," said Clisson. "You have my word. You can go free together."
"And the others?"
"They are traitors and shouldn't concern you. Tell me where Garrick is. Now."
"You're in a hurry, aren't you?" Aaron thought, and suddenly he realized what he hadn't seen before. Clisson needed him. He tried to hide it, but there was urgency in his questioning. So maybe the Iron Hand didn't have Keel or Grub after all. Maybe Aaron was the only lead they had. Knowing that, Aaron's fear receded a little. That was a lever with which to push back.
"What's Garrick's real name?" he asked, out of nowhere. If Garrick and Keel wouldn't tell him, perhaps his enemy would, and he had to stall Clisson to give himself time to think. He was gratified to see a spasm of fury cross the Overwatchman's face at the delay. A small victory, but a victory nonetheless. He saw Clisson considering whether to answer.
"Give me a little," Aaron thought. "Help me trust you."
"They called him Cadrach of Darkwater." Aaron was disappointed. He'd hoped for a revelation, but that name meant nothing.
"Who are they?" he asked.
Clisson shook his head. "You have his name. I will tell you who he is and who your father was after you have given me what I want."
Silence.
The flame flickered and twitched in the lamp. Aaron felt the chill of the cell seeping from the walls. Clisson's offer hung between them. Freedom for Aaron and Cade in return for Garrick. But if he told Clisson where Garrick was, everyone at Mara's would be arrested. Fenn, Orica, all of them. He wouldn't die for Garrick's sake, but he couldn't sell out the others. No solution. No way out. Only bad options.
"Where are your dreadnoughts?" he asked, playing for time.
I suppose the Emperor doesn't want them in the city during the wedding celebrations. It wouldn't give the right impression to the Harish. I mean, why would you need to employ abominations when we Ossians are all so happy with our lot?
Clisson's patience was at an end. He leaned close, his voice soft with threat.
If I have to ask you again, there will be no mercy, for you or for Cade. Do you understand?
But Aaron heard what was behind the threat, heard the fear of failure, which the Overwatchman didn't even admit to himself. He saw into him, then, this small, strange-looking man, beset by enemies on all sides, both real and imagined. Every day he was forced to prove himself against men who were more handsome, richer, better favoured than he, driven to succeed because success was the best vengeance against them. To that end, he had to capture Garrick at all costs, and fast. Anything less would prove his detractors right. Aaron knew what he must do then, and his own fear vanished.
"I'll tell you what I understand," he said. "You didn't catch Keel, or you'd be talking to him, not me. Keel saw me at the inn, but he doesn't know if I got away. Unless I turn up very soon, he'll assume I've been arrested. Then Garrick will know he's been compromised, and he'll disappear, and you'll have lost your chance." He fixed Clisson with a look of calm determination. "So you're short on time, Overwatchman, and you need to make a better deal."
Clisson barely managed to keep the amazement off his face. He'd thought he was dealing with a scared boy whose fragile adolescent truculence would be quickly overcome. Somehow, that scared boy had just gained the upper hand.
"I'll give you Garrick," Aaron said with a confidence that belied his years. "Just him, though. I won't give up my friends, but then you don't care about them. In return, you give me back my father's lands, property, and wealth. Cade and I will return to Shoal Point with a public pardon and will never see you or the Iron Hand again. In addition, after I've delivered you Garrick, you'll tell me everything you know about who he is and who my father was."
"And if I agree to this, you'll tell me where he is, right now? And have you arrest Cade and the others too? Forgive me, but I have a hard time believing you'd let them go again. My faith in Crodan promises isn't what it once was." It was all Clisson could do not to grind his teeth. He wasn't supposed to be negotiating with a prisoner.
"Then what do you propose?" he said.
"Set me free. I'll tell them I was lying low in the city. They'll believe that. Tonight, Garrick intends to go into the ghetto."
"Why?"
"It doesn't matter. He's going. You'll have men waiting. I'll lead him to them. Only Garrick. The others won't even know what happened.
And Cade will never know what I did for him, because if he did, he'd never speak to me again."
"You have a couple of hours at most before they decide I've been captured," said Aaron. "That's not counting the time it would take to assemble your soldiers and get there. I can't hold out against your tortures forever, but I reckon I can hold out long enough."
"Can you?" asked Clisson. "Would you like to find out?"
"Would you?" There was steel in his gaze, enough that Clisson believed him. When Aaron set his will to something, it wasn't easily broken.
"Let's say I release you," Clisson said.
"Why would you not simply go back to them, warn your friends, and disappear?"
"You'll just have to trust me, as I will trust you not to hang me when this is done."
"Not good enough."
"It'll have to be."
"No. I'll have Garrick one way or another. If not today, then some other day. But I won't have you run off and make a fool of me. So you need to convince me. Otherwise, you stay here, and there is no deal. You will not like our hospitality, I guarantee."
Clisson's gaze bored into him. Aaron shifted in his chair. The Overwatchman was determined that he wouldn't have it all his own way, and Aaron saw he wouldn't flex on this. Now it was his turn to give something up.
"I hate him," Aaron said at last, and it felt so very true. He'd have died rather than give up any of the others, but Garrick was a price he could pay, if that would save the rest.
Why?
I hate him for causing all of this. I hate him because he hates me.
And you don't know why he hates you, and that makes it worse, Clisson surmised. Yet still you follow him. So I must ask again, what did he say to you?
He didn't say anything, Aaron murmured.
All the confidence had gone out of him now. In its place was naked resentment, the burning, thwarted anger of youth.
He showed me, instead. Made me believe. I hate him for that most of all.
You admired him.
I thought he could make a difference. I thought I could.
And now?
Aaron looked away. Your man didn't catch me. Ossians did. My own people.
So what's the point? You said it yourself. The smart player wins the peace.
I want to go home. I want it back how it was.
And Garrick?
Damn him. Enough lives have been lost on his account, my father's included. He's not worth mine.
Clisson nodded to himself, a finger against his lip, considering. If you deliver, Garrick, he said at last, your lands will be restored and the stain wiped from your family's name. You and Cade can live in peace.
But listen hard, Aaron. If you betray me, I will catch you, and I will take the price of your treachery out of your friend's hide. You will watch as he is tortured to death over many days. Then I will start on you.
He paused to let that sink in. Aaron was in no doubt that he meant it. They'd ridden their luck too far already. Death and failure were all that awaited them if they carried on. The Iron Hand were everywhere, and they had not only Dreadnoughts on their side, but most of Ossia, too, bound to them by fear. What could two boys from Shoal Point do against that?
I wish we could go back to how it was, Cade had said to him in the shackle market.
Well, Aaron had found a way. They'd go back to the time before Fenn, before Garrick, before they were imprisoned and disgraced. Back to simpler days, when they were friends without conditions or complications, and they had no notion of the hells the world held in its hollows. They'd go home.
Do we have an accord? Clisson asked.
Aaron held up his hands, raising his manacles until the chain was taut against the ring in the floor. A gesture that said, free me.
Your father would be proud of you, said Clisson, and he drew a key from his pocket.
72. Orica's fingers shifted and slid across the fretboard, searching for the right shapes to frame the melody her voice described. Her eyes were closed, words drawn up from a well of sadness and anger deep within her, emotion given form by lips and lungs and tongue.
He said, I see no clouds and the waves are not high. Your omens mislead you, your bones fall awry. But the seer said, Sire, not all storms come from the sky. There are depths to which you cannot see. The tide is returning and coming right soon. It brings with it those you have sent to their doom. There's a wolf in the waves who yet howls from its tomb, and the fallen keep long memory.
Then the king said, You lie, for this land is my land, passed on to me by fate's bloodied right hand. But, Sire, said the seer, though you think you command, your rule is but fleeting here. There are elder things yet than the god you obey, and none may lay claim to this soil, try you may. For this land will be here after you pass away, and its children will still persevere. As she reached the end, she faltered, the spell of the music breaking. Something wasn't right. Something didn't ring true. She let the notes fade and tried to determine what it was.
That is a dangerous song to sing, Mara observed.
Orica opened her eyes. She was sitting cross-legged on a stone bench in a granite-flagged nook amid Mara's expansive gardens. Harrod was at her side, as ever, companion and guardian both. Orica hadn't heard Mara approach. Behind her, the house towered against a blue sky grilled with cloud.
If someone were to overhear you, they might mistake it as something other than a ballad of a long-dead king. They might think it a warning to our new rulers, Mara continued. A call to arms, even.
Can a bard be blamed if her words are misinterpreted? Orica asked with a small smile.
She put out a hand as Harrod drew breath to come to her defence.
Peace, Harrod. I suspect a call to arms would not find disfavour in this house.
Indeed, after 2 weeks with their mysterious saviours, it would take a blind woman not to see they were plotting against the Empire. She'd guessed it from their furtive conversations even before the Dreadknights appeared. But Orica was comfortable with secrets, and she let them have theirs. Harrod had urged her to leave them behind as soon as they reached Morgenholm, saying they were risky company to keep. He believed that no one else could be trusted, that he alone could protect her. Since the events at the Reaver's Rest, Orica wasn't sure that was true.
"Just a few days," she said, so as not to wound his pride. "Let us see how the land lies."
Since then, she'd learned that the ghetto had been emptied of sards, and the land lay bleak and bare indeed.
"I think my song has become too melancholy," she said, and she knew then why it had felt wrong to her. "It was intended to inspire. Somewhere in the crafting it has lost its hope."
Mara considered that, studying her thoughtfully.
"Do you play castles?" she asked.
"I know how, though I've no great skill."
"Will you play with me? It's something of an obsession of mine."
"It would be my pleasure," said Orica. She looked up at Harrod, who understood at once.
"I will practice my forms," he said, laying his hand on the blade at his hip. Then he bowed to Mara. "You have an excellent garden, milady. My thanks for your kind hospitality."
"Honoured guest, thy presence is thanks enough," Mara replied in flawless Harish.
"And thy knowledge of the tongue of my homeland does thee great credit," Harrod replied, and bowed again, deeper this time. Then, with a last glance at Orica, he left. Orica packed up her loot, and they walked back to the house together. A cool wind rustled the trees and stirred the flowers lining the paths. Birds hopped and fluttered in the afternoon sun. Orica sensed that Mara had something to ask her and was intrigued. It might help her choose which way she should go next. The world had a way of providing new paths if you knew where to look for them. The aspect who watched over her people was Prin the Ragged Mama, and she was a trickster, apt to disguise opportunities as setbacks, and vice versa. They made small talk as they headed to the parlour, where the castle's board was waiting. Mara didn't make for easy conversation at first. Unlike most Ossians, she found the art of speaking about nothing a little difficult, but she warmed up when Orica got her onto the subject of her school. Orica couldn't help but admire her passion, or notice the anger underneath. She spoke of the girls as if they were her daughters, taking pride in their achievements and bearing the blame for their failings. She reminded Orica of the Quelith, the teacher mothers who travelled among the caravans of her people. Mara's housemaid, Laria, a sallow young woman with a red birthmark across much of her face, served wine, while Mara reminded Orica of the rules. As they set to playing, it soon became clear that Orica was outclassed. She lost half a dozen of her best pieces in an ill-advised assault across the river. Her attempt at a counter-attack was met with a wall of archers and trebuchets occupying the higher ground, and she was decimated. No matter. Her defeat had been inevitable, and it wasn't about the game after all. This was only a stage for Mara to play out the proposal to come. It was the way of sards to look beneath the surface of things. To her people, face value held no value at all.
"Garrick told me how you met," Mara said, as she slid an assassin into an area of the board where it would serve no purpose that Orica could see.
"Harrod and I owe him much for his aid," Orica said. "Without him and his companions, we would have been arrested by now, and likely killed."
"I understand you let him use your cart to get to Rackan Bay, and you lost it there, along with many of your possessions."
"The ragged mama plays her tune, and we cannot but dance," said Orica.
The aspects give and they take away.
Mara said nothing to that, her eyes on the board as Orica pondered her next move.
He also told me why you were travelling to Morgenholm.
It was no secret. I sought my relatives, and now I learn they have been moved on again, if they were ever here at all. I despair of finding them.
She didn't try to keep the disappointment and grief from her voice. Assad was never ashamed of honest emotion.
Mara looked sympathetic. What will you do?
That is the question I've been asking myself, said Orica, sliding her remaining giant towards an unoccupied castle on the far left of the board, where there was a break in the line of blue counters that signified a ford in the river.
Should I head east in search of them, with few supplies and no transport, while all around me Sards are being plucked from their homes in their hundreds? Likely I would not last a week. Should I go elsewhere, then? Perhaps to Galtis, where we could live off my music, and I could forget the plight of my people?
Except, of course, that you wouldn't.
No, said Orica darkly, because how could she live with not knowing? Her whole race was being rounded up and removed from Ossia, taken east to an unknown destination and an uncertain fate. Slavery? Death? Her mind shied from the possibilities. It beggared belief that this could happen in a civilized land, that thousands of people could just disappear, with hardly a murmur from those they'd once lived alongside. The thought made her furious. Didn't Sards belong to Ossia too? Didn't they walk the same earth, breathe the same air? The people of this land enjoyed their craft markets and performances, stole Sard fashions, and fantasized about the mysterious lives they imagined Sards had. No doubt there were plenty who were concerned and sympathetic, Ossians and Crodans alike. But when it came to it, no one spoke up for them. Mara moved a piece and took one of Orica's.
If you choose to leave the country, I can provide transport and safe passage to the border. If you choose to go east instead, I can at least give you a cart and horses, and supplies to replace those you have lost.
You are very generous, Orica said neutrally, keeping the suspicion from her voice.
Generosity is giving what you cannot easily afford. Garrick's debts are mine, and you should be compensated for your losses.
He saved our lives, but I accept nonetheless with thanks.
I would ask only that you both stay with me until I can make the necessary arrangements. You will, of course, be well looked after.
I see, said Orica. Until after the wedding?
Mara smiled wryly. It would not be safe to travel until then. The roads are heavily patrolled.
How could I refuse such hospitality? Said Orica, and wondered if she was really being offered a choice.
Mara had just confirmed that whatever the plan, it would happen at the wedding, and Orica and Harrod knew enough to sell them out to the Crodans if they chose to. Mara didn't need to worry on that account, of course, but Orica understood the need for caution. Trusting strangers was an idiot's game. Mara picked up an ivory draken and flew it across the river.
There is a third way. Stay and fight with us.
Orica met Mara's eyes across the castle's board.
I am no warrior, she said.
Nor I, but not all wars are won by force of arms.
I have heard your song, Orica. We share the same dream.
Orica sat back, the game forgotten for a moment. She hadn't expected this. Until now she'd avoided prying, but if she was to make a choice here, she needed to know what manner of people they were.
Why do you fight, Mara? You have wealth and comfort. The occupation has been kind to you.
It was meant to provoke. Mara almost rose to it, but caught herself at the last moment. She gave Orica a tight smile.
I was born to privilege, it's true, but my family's wealth was modest. I will tell you how I bought this house and obtained such riches as I have. Maybe then you will not think the occupation has been so kind.
She sipped her wine and waved at the castle's board.
But take your turn, please. I can't bear to leave a game unfinished.
Orica moved another piece, and Mara talked as they played.
I was considered something of a prodigy in my youth. I devoured books and learned languages so I could read more. Knowledge came easily to me. I had read Tekaput's Disquisitions by age 7, mastered Ithkilian's Uncertain Formulae by 9. I built things and designed what I could not build. I ran rings around my tutors in rhetoric, and I played castles, a lot. It was my unquestioned destiny to go to the Glass University, to invent wonderful things and to solve the insoluble. My name would echo through the ages, as loud as Tekaput or Chalius or Jessa Wolfsheart herself. She paused, and her eyes narrowed. Then came the Crodans. I was no longer allowed to study, or to take meaningful work. For years I suffered this, and sought to work within their system. I was special, I thought. Surely if I tried hard enough they would notice. But they did not. I am a woman, after all. The Acts of Thomas and Toven say that a woman of ambition is a greedy thing, a malcontent, unwilling to play her role in society. But still I designed and invented, still I calculated and dreamed. I had no choice. Only death would have stopped me. Orica was barely paying attention to the board anymore, but Mara's conversation didn't appear to distract her from the game one bit. She moved with the same precision and speed of thought whether she was talking or not. Finally, I could bear it no longer. I had a friend who lost his leg below the knee, fighting the Erds during the 6th Purge. He was a fool, caught up with dreams of joining the Knights Vigilant, but that is by the by. He came home wounded, with a crude peg in place of his shin. I saw how he suffered with sores from that ill-fitting peg. I saw how people treated a proud man like a beggar just because he walked with a crutch. So I designed a new leg for him, from leather and metal, that imitated the movement of the bones and muscles in a human foot. With a little practice, he could walk again, unaided. "That is miraculous," said Orica. "I have seen such devices, rare and expensive, but amazing nonetheless." She frowned. "But..." Mara raised a finger. "Ah, there you see. He urged me to show my invention to the world, to help others like him. But I knew no one would allow such an invention if it came from a woman. I would be cried down and shamed. And a year later, an identical device would appear, built by a man. Yet I could not just keep it to myself. My workshop and study were already crowded with discoveries I had been forced to hide away. I had thought of publishing some anonymously, but..." She spread her fingers helplessly. "But I was still that little girl who dreamed of being immortal." "That is no bad thing to dream," said Orica. "It is something we have in common, I think. I would have my music played in 100 years, 1,000. That would be my immortality. But like you, I face certain obstacles of birth." "Then don't make my mistake. I was determined to take what control I could. So I approached a man I knew well, a man I trusted implicitly, and put a proposition to him. He would pretend to have invented the device and take a cut of the proceeds, but the lion's share, almost all of it, would come to me. I swallowed my ambition for the good of my fellow folk and gave the credit to a man." "You invented the Maliard limb?" Orica asked. She saw how the name pained Mara, and just for a moment the older woman faltered in her demolition of Orica's forces. "The Maliard limb," said Mara. "Yes. Originally it bore another name, but the community had its way in the end. They fell over themselves to celebrate the new inventor in their midst. What genius! What a service he'd done for the lame and unfortunate! How they toasted him!" "But he paid you, yes?" "Oh, in that he was as good as his word. And he still is, hence my fortune. He has done me no wrong. That I did to myself." "You couldn't bear seeing another take the credit," Orica said. "I couldn't bear seeing a man take the credit," Mara snapped. "Even a good man like him. I couldn't bear to see other men make him a hero, to see him laughing among them, all content in their own cleverness, while I languish with my riches, unknown and forgotten, and all because of the Crotons, because of a damnable book scribbled down by some ill-educated preacher. They took our futures away from us. They made us nothing, and Ossian men let it happen. In her fury, she'd raised her voice. Now she calmed again, took another sip of wine, and glared through the tall windows to the patio outside. I wish they'd invaded 20 years earlier. At least then I would not have grown up with hope. That is the worst of it.
Orica surveyed her meagre forces on the castle's board. She was heavily outnumbered now. Not even the best player could fight their way out from that.
I grieve for your plight. I do. But I am a Sard before I am a woman. My people have been nothing for a long, long time.
Mara looked back at her, her face frosty.
Let them treat you like nothing for long enough, they'll start to think it's true. Look what's happening to your people now, vanishing from the face of Ossia, and who will stop it? Not the Sards. You have too long accepted your lot. Not the Ossians, who can barely raise themselves to throw off their own shackles. Who is fighting for you?
Are you fighting for my people, then? Orica asked sarcastically.
We are fighting the Crotons, said Mara, and a common foe makes allies of the wariest strangers.
She picked up the assassin that Orica had forgotten about.
Or you can go east and be arrested, or you can turn away and go north.
She slid the assassin across the board through a hole in Orica's lines and tapped it against Orica's king, knocking him over.
Game.
Orica finished her wine in a single swallow.
I will think on what you have said, she told Mara as she got to her feet and picked up her lute. I must return to my song now.
She looked down at the board. Mara had barely lost a piece.
My apologies. I didn't offer you much of a challenge.
That's quite all right, said Mara. Nobody ever has.
73. It was early evening by the time Arryn reached Mara's house, and the shadows of Morgenholm's ancient ruins lay long over the reddening city. He hurried up the tree-lined avenue to the gate with a rolling nausea in his stomach. His skin felt clammy, and despite the mild day, he couldn't seem to get warm. As he approached the gate, he checked over his shoulder, intending to walk on by if he saw anybody. There was no one in sight. That was a little reassuring, but not much. The fear of the Iron Hand was deeply rooted. They were near mythical forces of dread, like the hollow man who'd once stalked his nightmares. Even if he couldn't see them, they could still be out there, following him. He'd insisted on being taken back to the Burned Bear so as to offer no clue as to his friend's whereabouts. From there, he'd set off in the opposite direction to Mara's. Clisson was canny enough to have him tailed, and if he led them back to Mara's house, the Iron Guard would be on them before nightfall. It had been a fraught few hours trying to shake off the men he knew must be there. Sometimes he thought he'd identified one, a cold thrill of recognition as he glimpsed a face he'd spotted a few streets earlier, but then they'd head off a different way, and he'd be left doubting again. In the end, he had to accept that if the Iron Hand were tailing him, he wasn't skilled enough to know it. As a last resort, he slipped into an inn, left through the rear door, and clambered over the wall of the yard. Once he'd found his way back to the street, he felt a little better, and having done all he could to shake his pursuit, if there had ever been any, he headed to Mara's. Now he was here, he took a moment by the gate to collect himself. He needed to calm down, or the others would suspect something. His hands still trembled when he thought of his encounter with Clisson. He could hardly believe what he'd said in there. Only now did he realize what a gamble he took, how high the stakes were. Only now did it start to sink in, what he'd done, what he'd committed to do. He'd come terrifyingly close to the end today. He still had the scratch on his neck where Hart's blade had nicked it. Somehow, he'd talked himself into a second chance, but there wouldn't be a third. Not for him, and not for Cade. He rang the bell outside the gate, and Clea, Mara's dour bodyguard and driver, emerged from the house.
She approached along a short path that ran across the front lawn and unlocked the gate to let Aaron in. He was halfway to the house when Cade burst from the doorway and came running towards him. He barely had time to brace himself before his friend swept him up in a crushing hug.
"You made it! Gods, you had me worrying! Keel just got back. He told us what happened."
"You know, it's possible to hug someone without using all the strength in your body," Aaron said with what breath he had left. Cade dropped him back on his feet with a grin. Clea had gone into the house, passing Fenn as she came hurtling out with relief writ plain on her face. She halted awkwardly as she reached them, hesitated a moment, then plunged forward and threw her arms round Aaron too. Aaron was surprised enough that he didn't react at first. Then, gently, as if she were a fragile thing, he put his arms around her. Her thin body was pressed against his. He felt the rise and fall of her ribs. A pleasant flush of warmth spread through him. Over her shoulder, he saw Cade struggling to keep his smile. He gave his friend a helpless look. What could I do? She hugged me. But the guilty pleasure of her touch made it hard to feel any honest regret. She pulled away abruptly, brushed a frond of ginger hair behind her ear. "I'm glad you're back," she said, without looking at him. "It took me hours to make sure they were off my tail," he said. "Have you seen Grubb? He was there too."
"Not yet," said Cade.
He was still looking suspiciously from Fenn to Aaron, deciding if he had grounds to sulk. She'd never embraced him like that.
"Did you see him get away?" Fenn asked.
Their eyes went to the gate now, as if expecting him to appear at any moment.
"It was chaos in there," said Aaron.
"But if any of us could give them the slip, well, surely it's him." He didn't sound confident, and he wasn't.
"Aye, he's a slippy one, all right," Cade agreed.
Then, with a note of unexpected worry in his voice, "You don't reckon they got him, do you?"
"Got who?"
asked Grubb, who'd appeared behind them and was craning his neck to see what everyone was looking at.
"That mud-headed scarl who keeps following us about," said Cade without missing a beat.
"Pretty sure they didn't get him," said Grubb.
"Was there something wrong with the gate?" Aaron asked.
"Grubb thought we were trying not to be seen. Came over the wall. Is Bitterbracker back?"
"He's back," said Fenn. "Shut himself away in his room."
"Then all of us back," said Grubb happily, spreading his arms. "Ha! Stupid Crowdens can't catch us. Come here, friends."
Horrifyingly, they found themselves corralled in his arms, pressed close to the sour stink of him while they squirmed and fought to get away.
"Get off me!" Cade cried. "Ugh! You reek like the back end of a hog! Enough friendliness!"
But he was laughing through his outrage. The Skull's joy was infectious, and relief had made them all giddy. None of them had been lost, none of them condemned to the unspeakable tortures of the Iron Hand. Even Fenn was laughing now. She was less wary these days, more involved. Her defences were lowering. She was becoming one of them. Aaron tried to laugh too, but an icy cramp in his stomach turned it to a sickly smile. He saw the burgeoning happiness in her, the new light in her eyes, and it was beautiful. She was beautiful. But that light would be smothered soon. That happiness would die because of him. In that moment, he could hardly bear to be himself. He wanted to blurt out what had happened, the deal he'd made with Clisson, the betrayal hidden in his mind. But it had gone too far for that. He'd made his choice. He'd chosen Cade. They laughed, and it was an alien sound, strange and grating. He felt himself apart from them, a stranger in the circle. Only he knew the truth here. Only he could see their adventure was doomed to fail. Only he knew there was a traitor in their midst.
"You addle-headed idiots!" Garrick snapped as he came storming from the house, towering in his rage. "Get inside, all of you! You can still be seen from the street out here!"
The laughter died in their throats as he seized Cade by the collar and propelled him towards the door. With his other hand, he grabbed Aaron, but Aaron, with a surge of fury, knocked his arm away hard. Garrick rounded on him,
fists bunched, eyes blazing. Aaron met his gaze without fear. He was long past fear of this man.
"Don't you dare to test me," Garrick warned.
Aaron could see the effort of will it took not to punch him.
"I told you to stay here. Instead, you all went wandering into the city without permits and walked right into a Croden ambush. If just one of you had been caught, you'd have ruined everything we've worked for."
"Well then," said Aaron, churlishly defiant, "it's lucky we weren't." Garrick stared at him, unable to believe his ears. Then the rage drained out of him, and he chuckled bitterly and shook his head.
"You're something, boy. You bleat and mew about how you want the truth, how you deserve to know everything. Well, I trusted you with knowledge of our mission, and you repaid me by endangering the lives of everyone here. You're all children and fools, and you don't deserve to be part of this. Now get inside."
The force of his scorn withered Aaron to silence. Cheeks hot, he lowered his head and slunk towards the house. Garrick was right, and Aaron hated him for it. He'd been holding back information for good reason. By treating it carelessly, they'd squandered his faith in them.
"Yes, my lord, inside, my lord, right away, my lord," Cade muttered sarcastically once they were safely out of Garrick's earshot.
"Don't worry," Aaron murmured sourly. A quote came to his mind. "Let each humiliation be paid back 100-fold, and let no slight pass unavenged." It was only once he'd said it aloud that he remembered where he'd heard it. It was from the Acts of Thomas and Toven, and he'd spoken it in Croden. Cade gave him an uncertain look, perturbed by a tone in Aaron's voice he'd never heard before, and said nothing more after that. Aaron gave Garrick an hour to cool off, then sought him out again. He found him beside Vika, sitting on a stool by her bedside, dabbing her mouth with a damp cloth. A jug of honey mixed with milk stood on the side table. He entered the room warily. Not for the first time, he noted the reverence and respect with which the old warrior treated the druidess. What did she mean to him, he wondered. A remnant of bygone days before the Crodans came, when Ossian gods still ruled the land? "How is she?" he asked.
"Healed as far as the eye can tell," said Garrick without turning around. "When she will wake, I do not know, but I reckon it must be soon."
Aaron came closer. She'd lost weight, face gaunt and collarbones stark in the red light of evening that spilled through the window. There were more threads of grey in her long black hair than before. Her lips moved as she muttered inaudibly. "Does she still speak of Kar Vishnak and the torments?"
"She speaks of nothing else. Once she spoke in a voice that wasn't hers, in a language which I swear was no human tongue. God spit, I wish I could unhear that."
He put the cloth aside with a sigh.
"What do you want?"
Aaron's eyes were still on Vika. He'd been fretting about her since Rackan Bay, but he was glad she wasn't awake to hear him now. She had a knowing way about her, and she'd always seemed kind. She might have seen through him, and her disappointment would have been hard to endure. "I want to apologize," he said. Even insincere as he was, it was hard to say it. Garrick looked up at him. The scar at his throat gaped as the ruined flesh stretched. That's where his throat was cut. That's where his soul fled his body. The hollow man.
"Aye," said Garrick. "You should."
Aaron found himself unexpectedly fighting for words. "I was angry at you. I'm still angry at you. But what I did, that's not..." He cursed. He'd had a plan of what to say, but it had deserted him, and he found himself saying something else instead, closer to the truth. "I was always the leader back home. It's hard to be kept in the dark, hard to obey without knowing the reason. I didn't realize the trust you were putting in us, telling us about the plan. Thought I was entitled to it. I suppose I've always had a hard time knowing my place."
Garrick grunted. "Aye, well,
Sometimes that's no bad thing, and there was no harm done this time. But you came damned close, Aaron, damn close. You could easily have been caught.
I know, and I want to make it up to you. Let me come with you tonight, into the ghetto.
Garrick snorted. He got up from his stool, flexing stiff knees.
After what you just did? I reckon not.
I want to prove that you can trust me.
Garrick shook his head.
You'd be dead weight in there. You can barely handle a sword.
I can handle one well enough. I've killed men, you know that. And I'm fleet of foot. I escaped the Crodans once today. Besides, who else would you take? Keel? He's a mess. Fenn can draw a bow, but she's no use in a close fight, and in those alleys...
I don't need help, Garrick said.
Then why are we all still here?
As I recall, you didn't give me much choice. I tried to send you away. You got us into a fight and brought the Iron Hand down on us.
That's an excuse. You could have sent us away any time after that. But you didn't, because you can't do this alone. You said it yourself. We'll all be needed when you have the Ember Blade. To carry the flame forward, spread the word, inspire the people.
Aaron was breathlessly earnest now, caught up in his own argument.
So let me show you, Garrick. Whatever you thought of my father, he and I are not the same. There shouldn't be bad blood between us if we're bound to the same cause. Let it be over.
A strange light had come into Garrick's eyes as Aaron spoke, something Aaron couldn't read. Sizing him up, perhaps, assessing him anew.
Trust me, he thought at Garrick. Trust me.
At last, Garrick sighed.
Aye, he said thoughtfully. Let it be over. Come with me.
He led Aaron from the room and down a corridor to Mara's study. Aaron gawked at the multitude of books, while Garrick brought down a scroll from a shelf and flattened it out on the desk. Printed in faded ink was a crescent-shaped tangle of curving streets and alleys enclosed within a meandering wall. The legend beneath, written in Croden, read, A Map of the Sard Quarter of Morganholm. Aaron studied it with amazement. Seeing the extent of the ghetto gave him a sense of how many must have lived there, how many had been taken away. Garrick jabbed a finger at the map. An unremarkable street on the east side.
There, third house along. That's Yarin's place. That's where he's stashed the information we need.
He straightened, surveying the ghetto critically.
We'll find somewhere dark and quiet to climb the wall and make our way in. It's too long for the Crodans to watch all of it. There'll be patrols on the other side watching for looters and any sards still in hiding. But we'll be on our guard. If we're seen, we run, or fight if we have to. Get yourself killed, by all means. Just don't get yourself captured. Clear?
Aaron nodded. Just like that, he had their destination. Now he could take it to Clisson. He was dazed by how quick it was, how easy. Usually Garrick kept his cards close to his chest until the last minute. Fortune favoured the treacherous, apparently. The thought made him feel sick.
Study the map, said Garrick. Memorize it as best you can.